Thank you very much, President Brademas. Mr. Ruska, my friend and colleague, Judge Kaufman, distinguished guests, in conferring any honor in connection with the subject of judicial administration, as you have done tonight with reference to Judge Kaufman and, in turn, Mr. Weinberg, we serve to remind ourselves of what men like Arthur Vanderbilt have done in the past. And we're here to pay tribute to him tonight, and you have spoken accurately of what he has done, and I surely endorse the proposition that while he was making pioneer steps in New Jersey to improve the administration of justice, as a sideline and dean of this law school, he brought it to be one of the foremost law schools in this country, from which I have had more law clerks than from any other law school. All that time, he was the point man for improvements in the administration of justice. Perhaps the most visible symbol of what he has done is the Institute of Judicial Administration and the other great institutes in the Vanderbilt Law Center. It is a gloomy exercise indeed to speculate what would have happened if it had not been for his leadership in that period when there were all too few leaders and judges and lawyers concerned about judicial administration. And we do well to keep that in mind as we try to look ahead tonight. Now, Judge Kaufman has spoken of the contributions of Mr. Weinberg. I have no close personal acquaintance with Mr. Weinberg, but I know of his work for the Institute ever since he took it over from his father. I should say that anyone who can bring about the balancing of the budget of the Institute of Judicial Administration is a financial genius of the category of Alexander Hamilton. And I join in thanks to you, Mr. Weinberg. Irving and others have spoken of some of the other developments in recent years, and it was the inspiration of Vanderbilt that led some of us in more recent times to forge these new institutions they spoke of, the National Center for State Courts, the Institute for Court Management, the State Federal Councils, the Appellate Judges Seminar, the National Institute of Trial Advocacy, and to convene the Williamsburg Conference on the Judiciary of 1972, and the Pound Conference of 1976. And each of these enterprises, in turn, expanded the frontiers set by Vanderbilt, and in turn stimulated a great many other activities. And he would have been here. If he had been here, Arthur Vanderbilt would have been one of the leaders in each of those new programs. Perhaps more than any other judge of his time, he understood the great principles and great doctrines of law are not self-executing, that increasingly in this complex modern society of ours, these principles of law require vehicles if they are to have meaning. The vehicles are the courts, and the drivers of those vehicles are the judges, and now, more and more, the court administrators. And it was no mere coincidence that when the National Center for State Courts sought a permanent leader, they drafted Edward McConnell, the pioneer court administrator who was trained by Vanderbilt as its director. And when the Institute for Court Management was founded in 1970, organized to train court administrators that were so desperately needed and were not available, Ed McConnell, Vanderbilt's protege, was on the faculty. As the courts were confronted with more and more cases and wholly new kinds of cases arising out of the complexities of our social and economic changes of the past century, courts tended to bog down for want of orderly administration. Even the very large increase in the number of judges in the past 30 years has proved to be only a partial solution. As a practical matter, the greater number of judges, the greater is the need for court administrators. Among many other talents Vanderbilt had was the gift for the pithy phrase, and on one occasion he'd said something to the effect that making improvements in judicial administration was not a task for the short-winded, but tonight I'll try to demonstrate that it's not necessarily a service to the cause to make them long-winded either. If Arthur Vanderbilt were here tonight, he would not want us to dwell on the details of what he tried to do. Rather, he'd point his finger, as he did sometimes, and say, let's get on with the job. And in that spirit, I want to turn now to some of the unfinished business in the field of judicial administration. Notwithstanding all that he did and all that he led, the unfinished business today is far greater than it was in his day. Roscoe Pound and Vanderbilt and others, although pressing for changes and greater efficiency, would agree that efficiency is not the primary goal of the courts. No one contends that it is. But they knew, and we know, that inefficient courts cannot perform their primary function of delivering justice fairly and swiftly and as inexpensively as possible. Let me review a few things that I've mentioned and others have mentioned from time to time in the past, and I've put just a few examples to you of areas to be reexamined. In the state courts first. Do we need judges, initially, to preside over the administration of the estates of decedents or of minors or of incompetents? Do we need judges, initially, to resolve child custody cases and related domestic matters? Do we need judges, initially, in divorce cases? Then, turning to the federal courts, consider a few examples. Do we need judges initially to administer bankrupt estates when only a small proportion of those cases involve contested legal issues that require judicial decision, and when those few cases can be referred to a federal judge? How can we regulate the use of pretrial procedures and discovery so as to prevent these things from becoming monsters destructive of the very objectives that led to their adoption 40 years ago? And even worse, sometimes to become a weapon, often benefiting lawyers more than litigants. How long must we wait to keep out of the federal courts an automobile intersection collision which reaches the federal courts only because one driver lives in Newark and the other in New York, or one lives in Virginia and one lives across the river in Washington? Indeed, is there any real need to have personal injury and property damage cases in the courts at all? Long ago, personal injuries of workers injured in their employment were moved into the administrative procedure that we know so well, much to the benefit of the workers, the employers, and the public. There are other areas that cry out for change, but these few examples will suffice to make the point that we must not cling slavishly to the status quo. There must be a better reason for doing things the way we're doing them than that hackneyed response, but that's the way we've always been doing it. A recent study by the RAND Corporation is very interesting. It indicates that the average cost to the taxpayers, not the litigants, the taxpayers, of a jury trial in all federal courts and in a major state jurisdiction that was surveyed is roughly $8,000 per case. Taking into account there only the direct operating cost of the courts, not the cost of the building in the first instance. The RAND study also tells us that the amount of the recovery in about three quarters of those cases, civil cases, examined in one typical, very large, major urban jurisdiction was less than $8,000. And that's not the whole story. The RAND researchers believe, tentatively, that the costs to the two contending parties in the litigation would substantially exceed $8,000. If this is even approximately correct, and I suspect it is, there must be a better way to do it. Think of it. At least $16,000 to process a vast number of the cases that yield $8,000 or less. This reminds me of an anecdote of our common friend, former Attorney General Griffin Bell, who said, "I can't help but remember the days when, as a young lawyer, I heard a federal judge cut short an admiralty case that involved $240, and weary of handling this matter that he thought had no business in the federal court, the judge said, 'We will now suspend court and take up a collection in the courtroom to pay off this claimant.'" In the same vein, when a prisoner went to the federal courts in 1972 on a claim of the loss of 3 packages of cigarettes, this having violated his civil rights, of course, the sensible district judge asked the Court of Appeals if he could dismiss the case by giving the prisoner 3 packages of cigarettes or $10. I don't know what happened to that case. It did not come to us. The needs of the present and of the future are suggested when we look at the record. Even these cold figures of the federal courts are instructive. Since 1942, the case filings in the federal district courts have multiplied more than 6 times, increasing the annual caseload for each district judge from 159 cases to 350. And in that period, of course, we had a great increase in the number of judges. The real meaning of these figures emerges when we see that the district court's civil cases increased more than 7 times as fast as the population, and courts of appeals filings have increased more than 10 times faster than the population. So we live up to our statement that we are the most litigious people on the face of this earth. There has been another very significant change in the work of the courts generally, and that is a change in the content of the cases. Cases that present issues far more novel and complex than in the past. Part of the reason for that is that in the past 15 years, as Judge Kaufman just suggested in part, Congress has enacted something over 100 statutes creating new causes of action and enlarging federal jurisdiction. In many of them, leaving to the imagination of lawyers and the ultimate judgment of judges whether there is a private cause of action available, implied in the statute. Now, many of these cases, I repeat, present issues on which the precedents are of very little help to judges. And if one wonders why the courts of appeals are dividing 2-1 and in en banc cases, 6-5, or the Supreme Court 5-4, there is a clue. Another problem. In 1960, for example, there were approximately 45 federal cases which took more than 1 month to try. That has now increased to 164, almost 4 times as much. The state courts are experiencing a similar increase in what we identify as the protracted case. This enlarges what is another new and related and serious problem. How are we going to find jurors who are able to and willing to sit on cases lasting 2, 4, 6, 7 months, and who also have the capacity to understand and cope with a mass of evidence, complex evidence, in such a long trial? The more complex the case, I'm sure we'd all agree, the greater is the need that we have a jury that has some members, at least, whose background and experience enables them to understand complex issues and cope with technical evidence. Yet the very nature of modern life is such that individuals who could best serve on those jurors as jurors avoid the jury service. How can we blame a small business proprietor or a person employed in management levels of a large company if they try to persuade the judge that it is an undue hardship on them to be absent even for 2 weeks, let alone 2, 3, or 4 months or more? So, the very cases that call for business experience or broad general education and broad experience are all too often not the cases on which we get that kind of a jury. A celebrated case here in New York, like the legend of Jarndyce against Jarndyce that we know about, continued year after year. Your New York case was a criminal case in which the defendant had waived the absolute right to a jury trial. Had that absolute right not been waived, I wonder if there is anyone in this room who would dare say that a jury trial could be conducted for 3, 4, or 5 years. Possible? Maybe. Likely? No. If we were to undertake any such an institutional folly of using or trying to use a jury in a trial that continues for years, we can only speculate how many alternate jurors we would need. Would it be 24, 48, 96, or 148? Or would we have to move to incorporate the doctrine of primogeniture so that the eldest child of each juror would take the place of the parent as the case dragged on? Now, please don't tell me this is such a rare occurrence that we need not worry, because today's rare cases have a tendency to become commonplace. And 164 protracted complex cases in 1 year in the federal courts absorb the court time in which many hundreds, if not thousands, of routine cases could be disposed of. Purely on the side of the juror for a moment, have we a right to expect a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter, to say nothing of bankers or brokers, to abandon their normal daily work and work at $30 a day for a long, long period of time? $30 may attract retirees, welfare recipients, unemployed persons, but what does that do to our vaunted claim that our juries are a cross-section of the community? Is it too much to say that now, having moved in the last 10 years, using six-member juries, as we do in 87 of the 94 federal districts, with all the savings of time and dollars that involves, that we may now be facing more and more cases, not just 164 a year, when 24 or more jurors will be needed in order to have enough surviving jurors to decide a case? To be sure I can't be misunderstood, let me make it clear that in criminal justice, of course, no one is about to suggest that we consider abandoning jury trials in criminal cases. But isn't there a better way to deal with the complex civil cases? That's what we must address. Arbitration is one obvious alternative. But unlike other highly industrial societies, developed societies, Japan and the countries of Europe, for example, Americans have never been entirely hospitable to arbitration. There are some promising straws in the wind, some encouragement. The American Arbitration Association informs us that they have increased arbitrations between 1975 and 1981 from 31,000 to about 38,000. Now, we must not experiment casually or thoughtlessly with alternatives to the courts, but we need to exhibit some of the same attitude of Leonardo da Vinci. We remember him, of course, as a genius in the arts, but he was also a pioneer, a genius in science and engineering. And in notes made by him, extant in Rome to this day, are found the frequent comments, "Try this, try that, try this, try that." And his flexibility may have had something to do with the fact that he anticipated the airplane and the helicopter by 500 years. Some of that spirit of Leonardo da Vinci must animate our profession today. The countries of Asia and Europe are challenging our American technology and our methods of marketing, and now in turn our industries are studying the methods of those societies that only a few years ago depended on our aid for their very survival. Is it too much to suggest that we study, I don't propose that we adopt, that we study the methods that other societies employ to administer justice? And let me mention just a few examples. I was brought up, and I suspect many of you were brought up, under the rubric that specialized courts are inherently undesirable. In my student days and in my early years of practice, it was impressed on me that all judges should be competent generalists, as many are, of course. But they become that way only after long experience. That they should be generalists as much as possible, there is no doubt. And there are some good reasons for not having any area of the law become the exclusive preserve of tunnel vision specialists. Another risk to be considered about specialized courts is that the single issue lobby groups, one of the great menaces to good government in America today, might exert improper influence to place partisan or single issue judges on these specialized courts. So that must be taken into account. No one can rationally say that setting up an impartial and balanced system of specialized courts would be an easy task, or that we should rush into it. Any move toward a greater use of such courts must be carefully thought out, but it must be thought about. A continued, rigid, unreasoning hostility toward specialized courts rejects centuries of experience of continental European countries where such courts have long been used and effectively used. In England, the source of so much of our judicial structure and of our substantive law, specialized courts have been in vogue for a long, long time. Their courts are not as rigidly compartmentalized as on the continent. Yet we find them in England divided, as we know, into the criminal court, a divorce or family court, a chancery court, a civil court handling commercial and admiralty cases. There's some flexibility for assignment of the judges as needed from one court to another, but essentially England has long since abandoned the idea that robes, supplemented by wigs, can convert even the best of advocates, and they do have great advocates, into universal experts on all of the law. The American experience for more than a half a century has been to move toward specialization in many, many areas, including the professions. The practice of medicine is perhaps the most dramatic example, and law firms, as we know, for 30 or 40 years have been following that example. Modern medical clinics, or a modern law firm in New York or Washington that undertook to assign patients or clients by seniority or by rote as the cases or the patients came in without regard to the specialized experience of the person to whom it was assigned would not survive very long. Who wants even the best eye, ear, nose, and throat specialist to take care of a coronary thrombosis? Or who wants a patent lawyer for a labor dispute? I think we have been overlooking too much in this area. But if the advocates must be specialists, as they now are in most of these areas, how can we continue to ignore the need for specialists on the bench? Another important lesson we can learn from England on a matter that is crucial in terms of time and expense is that reasonable limits can be placed on the jury selection process without impairing, and without having impaired, as we know, the extraordinarily high level of professional advocacy to be found in the courts of London. They do not allow the jury selection process to be used for days or weeks to brainwash the jurors before they hear the evidence. In England, jurors are often seated in the box, as our Anglo-American team found on several occasions, both in civil and criminal and the few civil cases where juries are used, in 5 or 10 minutes. And cases that take 3, 4, or 5 days in our courts are regularly completed in 1 day or a half a day in London. By careful use of questionnaires and other techniques, judges and lawyers can find out all they need legitimately to know about the process of selecting an impartial jury. Of course, this view will not find acceptance among those special pleaders of our profession who are really interested in getting a favorable jury, not just a fair and impartial jury. I think in California, it's nearing 1 year. They have only 6 alternate jurors left, and they took 3 months to pick the jury in the first place. I won't undertake to say what's wrong with that case because I don't know all the facts, but something is wrong when a case takes that long to try. In the 1930s, when the rules of civil procedure were being developed under William D. Mitchell and Charles Clark of the bar here of New York and of the Court of Appeals, the stated objective was to simplify litigation. So by narrowing the contested issues, they would speed up the trial process, and it was never intended to make it more complicated or to delay the process. But increasingly, for a dozen years or more, criticism, and I think valid criticism, has mounted on the misuse and abuse of this process. It is often said that we now try many cases twice, once in the pretrial and once in court. It is also said that some lawyers, suspecting or hoping to develop the existence of a possible claim, file a complaint and then launch a barrage of interrogatories and embark on a series of depositions to find out whether they have a case. I observed one set of boilerplate interrogatories with pages measuring more than an inch thick in all. The complaint alleged a claim against individual defendants, not corporations, individuals. But there were page on page on page of questions asking about the capital structure of the defendants, the number of shares and kinds of stock issued, the bonded debt, the names of the officers and directors, their salaries and bonuses. All this directed at individual defendants. Of course, we know that what the lawyers had done in that case was fire a broadside of boilerplate out of a word processing machine. And in doing that, they imposed a heavy and unjustifiable burden on another litigant. This must be dealt with. And I'm glad to say the Judicial Conference Committee on Civil Rules has been addressing this problem, and there are some changes in the pipeline. Of course, no rules can guarantee freedom from abuse. But if lawyers act irresponsibly, there is a remedy. In some circumstances, judges have a duty to impose a disciplinary, monetary sanction, not on the litigant, but upon the advocate who is abusing the process. A judicious and even-handed use of sanctions could serve to put a halt to some of the flagrant abuses of pretrial processes. Now, another problem that's been under discussion. The Supreme Court, at the pinnacle of our system, has long been feeling the brunt of the pressures that begin in both the federal and state trial courts. In recent months, there's been a growing awareness exhibited about this problem among judges and lawyers. That has been good. It has refocused attention on the reports of 2 very important studies, the Freund study of 1972 and the Ruska report, the committee jointly composed by the Congress, the executive, and the judiciary, chaired by Senator Roman Ruska of Nebraska. The Supreme Court workload is an even more acute problem today than when the Freund Committee was appointed in 1971 or when it reported in 1972. These recent commentaries have presented a variety of possible solutions, and I'm happy to see that there's a recognition that the problem will not solve itself, it will not go away, and it cannot be brushed under a rug. The suggestions recently advanced to serve these ends have really revived some interest in the problem. And whether we agree or not, this process is useful. It serves to stir some horses that have too long been asleep. And I'm delighted that the great reports of the committees chaired by Professor Paul Freund and Senator Roman Ruska are now coming into their own. Two bald figures on the Supreme Court's work are striking. In the first year that my distinguished predecessor, Chief Justice Warren, served, and that's not so long ago except to you very young people here, the court had 1,312 filings, and the court had 65 signed opinions, plus per curiam opinions, 19, I think. Last term, we had 4,422 new filings added to 889 carried over, or 5,311 in all, and we issued 114 signed opinions and 10 per curiam opinions. Ponder those figures, if you will, as I remind you that about a quarter of a century ago, when the Supreme Court was averaging 115, 117 signed opinions a year, Professor Henry Hart of Harvard, known to many of you here, wrote in his annual survey in the Harvard Law Review, "The conclusion emerges inexorably that the number of cases which the Supreme Court tries to decide by full opinion, far from being increased, ought to be materially decreased." Decreased from what? Decreased from 117, and last year 151 altogether. Apart from these bare numbers, qualified observers of the Supreme Court, familiar with its operations, practitioners and scholars, have commented on the extraordinary change in the content of the cases coming before the court. As I suggested, cases in which the novelty of the question is such that there are virtually no precedents, and as Judge Kaufman had suggested, often dealing with legislation with hortatory language inserted by way of a compromise or for some other reason, and the court is left to try to find out what Congress thought. Whatever decision the court makes, of course, it is then open to the charge that it is legislating. Some observers, qualified observers, have said that if we had only 100 fully argued cases a year, this new novelty of the questions would tax the capacity of the court to the limit. Computer aids, word processing machines, increased staffing in the past dozen years have helped some. But if every case in the Supreme Court is to continue receiving close individual attention of every justice, as has been the tradition, the caseload cannot continue even at the present rate. It is not just a matter of maintaining the present caseload. That caseload must be reduced one way or the other. I emphatically agree with Professor Hart and the others who have said we cannot cope with more than 100 full-scale opinions a year if the quality and the depth of treatment is to be maintained at a proper level. The Freund report made three major points, all related to the growth of filings and the growth of cases calling for plenary treatment. It recommended that three-judge district courts with that direct mandatory appeal to the Supreme Court be abolished, and except, happily for the reapportionment cases, Congress did act on that. That gave only modest relief. The Freund report recommended that all mandatory jurisdiction of all kinds be abolished and that all cases be placed under certiorari jurisdiction, discretionary jurisdiction. That has no opposition from anyone. It has passed the Senate once and the House once, and yet for years it has languished in the Congress. That too will give us only modest relief. The major recommendation of both the Freund and Ruska reports was that a separate new intermediate court be created with power to deal with cases referred to it by the Supreme Court. In approaching any discussion of this kind, it seems to me that the experience of other highly developed societies is surely relevant. On the continent of Europe, as I said, we find widespread use of the specialized courts, but that is not limited to the trial level. It carries on to the highest level. It is a common pattern on the continent to have the jurisdiction of the courts of last resort be divided into two and even three tribunals, for example, criminal appeals in one, civil in another, and administrative in a third. Sometimes a special court for constitutional cases only, as in France since 1958. At least two of our own states, Texas and Oklahoma, divide the state court of last resort jurisdiction between civil and criminal. And in the intermediate courts of appeal of many of the states, this pattern of separation is followed. It is reasonably clear, therefore, that the concept of separate appellate jurisdiction divided along these lines is not per se an alien or a subversive idea. Here again, the English experience merits inquiry. We share with England the common law tradition, and it's significant that the true tribunal of last resort in England is the High Court of Parliament, which acts through law lords who sit in two panels of five each. They reserve their calendar for only the most momentous issues. Each panel currently has barely 30 to 35 cases a year. The United States Supreme Court normally hears 24 cases in a two-week sitting. And that's every month from the end of September until the docket is cleared. That the law lords who have the last word in England also have other duties, such as sitting as members of the Privy Council, does not significantly alter this enormous disparity between the workload of the law lords of last resort in England and the justices of last resort in this country. Can it be that England, the fountainhead of all our legal concepts, after many more centuries of experience than ours, is wrong, and that our traditional hostility to specialized courts is correct? I'm not in any sense suggesting that we slavishly copy the models of England or of the continent or of Texas or Oklahoma. What I do suggest is that when the filings of the Supreme Court have almost trebled in my time as a federal judge, and the workings of many courts are falling into disrepair in spite of many improvements and the addition of court administrators, we must re-examine the mindset which brought us where we are today. We've reached the point where our systems of justice, both state and federal, may literally break down before the end of this century, notwithstanding the great increase in the number of judges and the infusion of 300 or 400 court administrators altogether in the state and federal systems. In the face of these constantly rising hydraulic pressures on the courts, the time certainly has come, I submit, to take a fresh, hard look and keep in mind John Locke's admonition of many years ago that new opinions are always suspected and usually opposed without any other reason but because they are not already common. And as we approach the bicentennial of the Constitution, perhaps this is the time to embark on a comprehensive study of the judicial process, picking up the work of the Williamsburg and Pound conferences and the Freund and Ruska reports. I'm well aware that there are risks even in suggesting that such sensitive, crucial subjects should be reviewed and re-examined in the light of our experience. The risk is that it will be said that the speaker is advocating a particular solution. I have never taken a position about the intermediate court in the Ruska or the Freund reports. I have, however, emphatically stated, and I would repeat it now, with even more emphasis, that if some changes are not made in the work of the Supreme Court, its work will fall more and more behind, and the quality will suffer. There is legislation pending in the Congress now for a commission to make a profound study, and that should help. It would be a step in the right direction. These observations should not be taken as a criticism of the Congress, for many of the leading members of the Congress in the House and Senate Judiciary Committees have been very helpful in recent years. The difficulty is we sometimes take one step forward and a step and a half back because of the glacial load of new cases. Glacial in the sense that it is moving irresistibly, but inexorably. What is important in all these problems is not the difference in the views of those who have spoken, but the harmony of purposes and objectives. A common underlying objective is to assure that the great concept of separation of powers and the checks and balances of our three branches of government are preserved. That can never be perfect, but it's the best so far devised by the human mind. That cannot be preserved if the Supreme Court must carry a load as heavy as it has been carrying for a quarter of a century. The danger to the Supreme Court and the judiciary does not lie in attacks on the court. There have been attacks on the court for 180, 190 years. The real risk is that the institution will be submerged gradually by placing on it burdens it cannot adequately carry. And we do well to remember what happened to that great naval fleet that King Philip of Spain sent against England when he so overloaded the ships with cannon and weaponry and crews that they became unseaworthy and were defeated by the smaller British fleet under Drake, carrying much lighter loads. The Constitution must always have preeminence, and the best guarantee for that is found in our history, but we must face up to the reality that when the demands on a court exceed the finite capacity of any nine human beings who could be assembled, that institution cannot perform the task in keeping with the standards the people of this country have a right to expect. They cannot be maintained with 4,000 to 5,000 filings a year and 140 or more opinions. For all other courts, the rising caseload can be largely solved by more judges, but that relief is not available to the Supreme Court. More justices would hamper, not aid our work. One more thought from Leonardo da Vinci may be relevant. He once said, "Inaction saps the vigor of the mind." Inaction on these problems of justice and the mechanisms of justice tends to freeze the flaws and sap the vigor of the mind without which progress cannot be made. But let me close on a more optimistic and cheerful note to brighten this otherwise doleful picture that I've been presenting. Remember Arthur Vanderbilt's admonition that the solution of these problems is not for the short-winded. Remember, too, that John Jay, the first Chief Justice, in 1791 suggested the creation of what are now the United States Courts of Appeals for the circuits, the intermediate court. Congress acted on that and responded in 1891, exactly a century later. I leave it to you how much longer we can wait.